You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Vice President Mike Pence was at the state capitol today to promote school choice. We'll look at what he had to say, as well as a state Democratic bill that would dismantle the voucher program. Now, recalls and concerns about food safety are in the news frequently, like the warnings about romaine lettuce tainted with E. coli that have been in the media on and off since 2017. But the American food supply is much safer than it was a century ago, and that's thanks in large part to a chemist named Harvey Wiley, who led the way in food testing and product labeling. His findings in the early 20th century depended on a team of knowing volunteers as guinea pigs. John Maggio is the award-winning writer, director, and producer of a new documentary on the topic that premieres tonight on American Experience. And Deborah Blum is the author of the book that brought this story to life. It's called The Poison Squad, One Chemist's Single-Minded Crusade for Food Safety at the Turn of the 20th Century. She's also director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Deborah, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
And John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. A real pleasure.
Deborah, let's start with our food landscape in the late 1800s. There were big changes going on, right?
Right. I mean, the late 1800s is really the shift from the small farm to the industrialized food supply. And so when that starts happening, you see these dramatic changes in what food is and how it's made and who decides actually what you're going to eat. It's really a fascinating and also crazy bad time for food.
And John, a lot of the stuff you show in the movie, the archival newspaper materials and things like that, over the time period you cover, this was a hot topic among the American people, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, you know, this is the beginning. We start to see the industrialization of food. We see Nabisco, Campbell's Soup, all of these big food manufacturers coming online. And most people had sort of, you know, a lot of immigrants, a lot of people moving to the cities to work who are used to, you know, like I'm Italian American, so I know there are a lot of Italian Americans who are used to living off the land and eating farm fresh food and suddenly are being told by Protestant aid groups that, no, you should be eating this canned stuff. And I think it really, you know, had an effect on it and really did so much to shape our food pathways, you know, even to today.
Now, this was a Wild West, the food processing industry. Deborah, to give a taste, let's pick a product we love here in Wisconsin, our milk. If I went back to, say, 1880, bought myself a quart of milk, what else was going to be in there apart from the milk?
Oh, you could not have picked a better example than milk. It's so crazy. So milk is watered, and with any old water, there was one case where the dairyman just like scooped stuff out of the swamp behind his house. It's recolored once it's thinned with chalk or plaster of Paris. They fake the cream sometimes, especially actually in the Midwest, by pureeing calf brains and floating a little scum of yellow on top. And, of course, because the milk rots, there's not refrigeration, there's not pasteurization, they use formaldehyde to preserve it, so it's also poisonous. You can look at newspapers across the country, and they have what they called embalmed milk scandals, where sometimes hundreds of children die in a single summer from this, you know, very special milk.
John, Deborah had been writing about this. Of course, she wrote the book on this. As you come into this project, are you amazed by what people encountered when they bought food, whether it was milk or canned meat or whatever, off the store shelf?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, the book is so vivid in the descriptions of the things that Harvey Wiley was finding and he was testing. I mean, from honey and maple syrup that was nothing but corn syrup to coffee that was ash and charcoal and dust from the manufacturing floor, green beans that were just filled with all sorts of chemical newfangled chemical preservatives. It really was a fascinating, vivid description in her book. And behind, you know, the push behind all of this was this absolutely fascinating whistleblower, this guy, Harvey Wiley.
Right.
He just wouldn't stand for it, you know. And so for me, the richness of all of that color of the period and what was going on in food safety or what was not going on in food safety. And then this super colorful character who's on this mission we had all the ingredients for a great film, and an important film, I think.
Right. Harvey Wiley, Deborah, this doctor slash chemist slash food scientist who becomes kind of a rock star in the country, introduces to him.
Yes, he was so famous that when the 1906 Food and Drug Law finally passed, it was known nationwide as Dr. Wiley's Law. I actually think of him, John's description of whistleblower is great because he blew the whistle on the food supply, but he was also kind of a real crusader, holy roller of a chemist. He grew up in a small farm in Indiana. He believed totally that it was important that science serve good, and he took food as his cause and made it a life work in ways that transformed the country, literally.
And there was pushback, Deborah, from the food processing companies, big companies, influential companies. Can you talk about how they reacted to Harvey Wiley's work?
Oh, they hated him. For the most part, with a few exceptions, the food industry and the chemical industry hated him. Monsanto was around then. They hated him, right? Dow Chemical hated him. Campbell's Soup hated him. And so they did all kinds of things to both publicly try to destroy his reputation and privately. And this was the other thing that was so fascinating to me, this behind-the-scenes handshake between government and business at this time, and privately just to destroy his job and his reputation in the government. And in the latter, they were pretty successful.
Talking to Deborah Blum, author of the book The Poison Squad, and John Maggio, award-winning writer, director, and producer of The Poison Squad for PBS's American Experience. John, talk about, Deborah had done a lot of this work, talk about what it took to get some of the archival footage. You've got amazing photos, occasionally newsreels of prominent figures like Teddy Roosevelt. What all went into putting this documentary together with that historical material?
Yeah, it was definitely, I was surprised to see, because it's the turn of the century, so there's not a lot of newsreel footage quite yet at that point. But I was surprised at the amount of it within, for instance, the Chicago stockyards. I mean, some of that footage of the meatpacking plants is so visceral. I mean, I think any American, anybody in the world who eats meat, may think twice about it after watching what was going on in the Chicago stockyards then. So that material I knew was fabulous. But I had to augment it. You can see in the film with some recreation that I tried to do. Tried to recreate Harvey Wiley in the laboratory, which was his warren, which was he was very comfortable in the laboratory doing experiments. And so I just wanted to make sure that people understood this was a man of science. I do call him a whistleblower. He really, as Deborah said, he was a crusader for pure food. So I wanted to sort of bring color to the film in that way, not just have it all be black and white.
And Deborah, let's meet the Poison Squad now. This amazing story that I hadn't known about until your work. Tell us what Harvey Wiley did to test borax and salicylic acid and all these other chemicals in our food supply.
Well, eventually he got so frustrated with the lack of response and his calls for actual labeling and in some food safety, that he decided to just test the additives as is on young government workers. And he recruited this group of, healthy, athletic young men in their 20s who were underpaid government clerks, and he paid them a big $5 a month, which went a lot farther in 1902, right? And he offered them 3 meals a day, 7 days a week. And the catch is that they have to take these capsules that contain the additive of the day or the one that he's studying. And so he adds in borax, he adds in salicylic acid, which was a big preservative in beer, by the way, at the time, in the U.S., not in Europe. He adds in formaldehyde, and he just looks at what happens to these guys at different levels as they're swallowing these very standard food additives that everyone in the U.S. is swallowing. And the thing that shocks him and then shocks the country is these very healthy young men start getting really sick.
Yeah, this is a big part of how he makes the case to the American people. And these guys, these Poison Squad guys, they kind of become celebrities in and of themselves, right, Deborah?
That's right. There were minstrel shows. There were poems. They are front page news. You have the Washington Post sending a reporter to skulk around the agriculture department kitchen and try to dig up their backstories. Actually, the Post got so frustrated with the way Wiley tried to control the information, they made up stories about the poison squad, and that added to their legend. And these guys in their way, I mean, they're young. They did not know how dangerous this food was. But they're heroes, right? They're going on this mission to do something for the good of the country. They ought to be remembered, and as everyone in the story ought to be remembered.
And John, apart from Deborah, who plays a big role in the documentary, you feature some very prominent modern-day food science scholars and activists, Mark Bittman, Eric Schlosser, Marion Nestle, Mark Karlansky, others. They all talk very passionately about this work. I'll admit, until Deborah's work, I hadn't heard of Harvey Wiley. Did you get a sense from her and all these other people that he was really this pivotal figure in our food history?
Well, absolutely. You know, and there are, you know, as Deborah was talking about his process, you know, there were flaws in his study. This wasn't a perfect study. It's one of the earliest of that type of study. But what he did was he raised an incredible level of awareness. He was the generator. He was the engine behind this movement. And what he did, though, he made a huge tent. He brought in women for the women's suffrage movement. He had hundreds of thousands of women writing letters. Even though they couldn't vote, they were an incredibly powerful voice and group in helping shape this. Fanny Farmer got involved, you know, who had an incredible reach through her cookbooks. So we have to credit Wiley with creating the momentum for this, but it's a whole host of people, including Upton Sinclair, you know, who's, I like to say that Wiley had taken the ball to the goal line, and Upton Sinclair sort of took it into the end zone with the publishing of The Jungle, which showed just how bad the situation was in the meatpacking plants. So he was the force behind it all, but it really was a movement, and it's incredible to look at, incredible to remember how important the progressive era was, you know, even bringing Roosevelt online, who was a little bit late to the game on food.
Deborah, I want to wrap up kind of back in the pre-Harvey Wiley era. Sometimes we think these days like, oh, back in the good old days, there was some kind of golden age of food. This clearly wasn't it. I think you say in the documentary at some point, basically everybody had stomach trouble all the time in the United States, given the food they were eating.
And that was a big shock to me because I had kind of bought in that old myth of the, you know, happy, pink-cheeked, healthy American eating nothing but wonderful food in the 19th century. The 19th century is actually known to medical historians as the century of the great American stomachache. And there are estimates that just your daily diet, just the food you ate and the drink you drank, was one of the top 10 causes of death in the 19th century. So we are very lucky to live on the other side of, as John describes it rightly, this Wiley-led revolution. And to live in an era where we do have food safety standards, we are very lucky.
It's a good place to leave it and then watch the documentary. Deborah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me on.
And John, thanks for sharing this with us.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Deborah Blum is the author of The Poison Squad and director of the Knight Science Journalism Program at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And John Maggio is the award-winning writer, director, and producer of The Poison Squad for American Experience that premieres tonight at 8 on both PBS Wisconsin and on Milwaukee PBS. Coming up, we'll look at the state of school choice in Wisconsin as Vice President Mike Pence promoted the program at the state capitol today. We'll pick that up coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get the latest analysis of the Senate impeachment hearings. First, it's National School Choice Week. Events are taking place around the country to promote alternatives to traditional public schools, including public charter schools, public magnet schools, private schools, online academies, and homeschooling. Vice President Mike Pence celebrated the occasion today at the State Capitol building in Madison.
When parents are given the opportunity to choose the best school for their children, whether that's public or private, parochial, Christian, or homeschool, outcomes improve. Kids do better. And education improves for everyone. Wisconsin has an extraordinary record of success with school choice, and every family in Wisconsin should be proud.
The vice president was joined by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Meanwhile, state Democrats say school choice robs public schools of funding. They introduced a bill today that would dismantle Wisconsin's voucher school program. Alan Borsak is a senior fellow in law and public policy at Marquette University Law School and an education columnist with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, the vice president was here. He highlighted Wisconsin's long history of school choice, said that Wisconsin was a key player in putting it on the map. Can you talk a little bit about that history here in Wisconsin?
Well, as a factual matter, he's correct that Wisconsin was the place where it was put on the map. 1990, I believe it was the first urban voucher program law in the country passed by the legislature. Tommy Thompson was the governor at that time. The program started in Milwaukee, very small in 1991, and stayed small until the state Supreme Court became the first court of that level or higher in the country in 1998 to find it constitutional to use school vouchers to send kids to private religious schools. And then the program began growing rapidly. At this point, a quarter of all the kids in the city of Milwaukee who are getting publicly funded education are going to private schools, almost all of them religious. And we're seeing the state as a whole, and there's a special needs scholarship program. They've all been added in recent years. There's over 40,000 kids in the state using public money in the form of vouchers to get education in private schools. So, yes, Wisconsin's a starting point. The vice president's statement about the, what was the word he used? Astounding or something?
Extraordinary, yeah.
Extraordinary achievement. That is way more debatable.
Right. That's been a debate since 1990, and you've been on this network many times talking about that, as have others. What do we know from the scads of research out there trying to figure out if these choice programs have improved student performance?
Well, in a couple broad strokes, they're all very popular. I mean, no one's forced to take a voucher. No one's ever been assigned to go to a private school. And almost all of them fill up every spot they've got. So they're very popular. Are they closing the gap overall between, say, low-income and high-income kids, black kids and white kids in Wisconsin? There's not much evidence to support that. Some of the voucher schools are really good. Some of them are not good. And the same is true for public schools and for charter schools. There's some really good ones and there's some not so good ones, and the overall achievement in all of the sectors combined hasn't budged much and is still very deeply concerning when it comes to reading and math and basics and of success in education.
One argument from the beginning was that, as I recall, was that, hey, having competition is also going to make public schools better. They're going to have to change their ways in order to keep students from leaving and joining these choice programs. Has that panned out in any way?
There are people who would tell you yes. Frankly, I'm not really one of them. I just don't see much that's changed in Milwaukee as far as the public schools. There was a period maybe from 2000 to 2004 where you could make some argument for that, but I just haven't seen it in recent years at all. Everyone is much more committed to fighting the sector wars between the public school people and the voucher school people, the private school people, and cooperation, growth, expansion, innovation. You don't hear too much about innovation and improvement.
Now, Republicans, including Vice President Pence, joined this event. State Democrats held an event of their own today to criticize school choice. Here's Wisconsin Democratic Party Chair Ben Wickler.
People of all parties and no party want high-quality public schools. They're one of the most popular things that happened in the United States. But the Trump, Pence, DeVos administration is systematically undermining support for public schools. That's profoundly unpopular, and it's why Mike Pence wants to change the subject.
That's been an accusation from critics of voucher programs. Alan, do we see that happening? Have resources been taken, in effect, away from public schools to go to voucher schools?
Well, you could argue that, and it's frankly, in my mind, a subject with a lot of grays and not a real black and white subject. When it comes to Wisconsin or to local school districts here, on the national level, despite the Trump administration positions, actually, nothing has changed. Education, or not much has changed. Education spending is, in fact, increased for public schools. And the voucher ideas, the tax credit ideas that the president, the vice president, that the secretary of education are promoting have gone absolutely nowhere in Congress, with no prospect that they're going to go anywhere.
So we've been fighting over voucher versus public versus charter versus choice for a long time. Are we overlooking maybe the things we should be arguing about when it comes to things that might work better to improve student performance?
Well, the arguing among the sectors hasn't proved much. And frankly, if you ask my opinion, I'd prefer if everyone sort of said, let's change what we can change and not argue over what we can't change and focus on the actual accomplishment of kids and what would work for kids. I think a positive sign, at least I hope, is that there's more attention being turned to reading instruction and ways to improvement. And that would apply to all the schools in the state, especially those serving low-income kids. And that's not a sector war. That's a let's help the kids matter.
Yeah, I haven't looked closely at this, Alan, but I saw that the Department of Public Instruction had a statement on phonics instruction. This is another, had been an eternal struggle in reading education, I recall, for a long time. What are we seeing there?
Well, I think you're seeing, and there's signs of this nationwide, there's signs of it in Wisconsin. We're seeing frustration that reading scores are so bad. In the city of Milwaukee, under 20% of kids are rated as proficient in reading at all grade levels in MPS, and it's only just a hair better in, among voucher students. So there's a lot of concern that this is just an enormous crisis. So you're seeing some response saying, well, maybe we ought to try something different because what we're doing isn't working.
And what are you watching for next? We've got this big push during National School Choice Week, vice president of the country here in Wisconsin. What's the next battle line on the choice issue?
I don't honestly know because I don't think there's any battle to be fought right now. I think the choice picture in Wisconsin is at a standstill. As long as the Republicans control the legislature and the Democrats control the governorship, nothing's going to change. The ideas that were floated by the Democrats today, whatever their merits, and I wouldn't take a stand on their merits, but they're not going to happen as far as state legislation, and there isn't a budget anyway until the spring of 2021. So I don't think there is a battle at the moment. There's just continually, Groundhog Day of advocacy by both sides.
Alan, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That's Alan Borsak, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, education columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Talked to him about Vice President Mike Pence's visit to Wisconsin to promote school choice. Coming up, President Trump is facing an impeachment trial in the Senate. We'll check out the latest coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, what's your pronoun? There's been a lot of attention lately to who gets called he, she, or they, and there's a lot more out there, too. Kate Archer Kent talks to a language expert about the past, present, and future of pronouns. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, today marked day 8 of President Trump's impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. The White House defense team featured statements from attorneys Pat Cipollone, Patrick Philbin, and Jay Sekulow. The team said they would not use the full 24 hours allotted to the White House team for statements and wrapped up mid-afternoon. The president faces two articles of impeachment, the first being abuse of power, the second being obstruction of Congress. The White House team spent much of their time today and yesterday criticizing the use of those two articles of impeachment specifically. They argued that the use of these articles could set a dangerous precedent. Here's counsel Alan Dershowitz yesterday.
I'm sorry, House managers, you just picked the wrong criteria. You picked the most dangerous possible criteria to serve as a precedent for how we supervise and oversee future presidents. The idea of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress are so far from what the framers had in mind that they so clearly violate the Constitution and would place Congress above the law.
Our next guest joins us for a look at today's proceedings and to talk about some of the political takeaways. Paul Nolet is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Well, what has stood out to you over the last day or so from the team representing the president before the Senate?
Yeah, I think over the last day and then really the 3 days of the president's legal team presenting their arguments, we're really centered on a couple of different things. One, trying to say there was no crime here, there was no quid pro quo, and then two, saying that this entire impeachment is really a sham, that President Trump didn't do anything wrong, and Democrats are really using this as an opportunity to try to get rid of Trump through this mechanism rather than an election. And so I think that was something that both today and in the two earlier days of their testimony was a consistent theme of President Trump's legal team.
And we've seen an argument, in effect, I think, that even if the president had done these things, Alan Dershowitz and others have said, that wouldn't rise to the level of impeachment, as we heard in that statement from yesterday there. The idea of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress don't even rise to the level of impeachment, even if the facts were established.
Yeah, and so Alan Dershowitz was really taking a maximalist argument in some ways, saying that impeachment doesn't embrace things like abuse of power and obstruction of Congress, the articles of impeachment involved here. Instead, he says that they involve actual crimes or criminal-like behavior. And I will say that that is generally a very much a minority position amongst legal scholars. I think most legal scholars say a crime is not required. It's broader than that. In terms of what can be impeached and then tried in the Senate. But nevertheless, Alan Dershowitz did make that argument, and that was a key plank of the overall arguments that the legal team made.
Now, how about the arguments on the factual basis, the accusations that President Trump was reaching out to foreign governments to interfere in the election, to announce proceedings, investigations of his political rivals? How did the team argue against the facts on that?
Yeah, there were a few pieces of that. And one was to say that there was nothing explicitly that could be described as a quid pro quo anywhere in the original transcript that were released or in the witness testimonies in the House. And the other part of that was also to talk about the Trump administration's relationship with Ukraine, which, of course, is at the heart of all of this. And part of the argument there is to say, you know, President Zelensky of Ukraine said that there wasn't any undue pressure on him or his government. And in fact, the aid was released without any promise of an investigation. And so those were some of the key facts that throughout this process the Trump's lawyers made those, pushing back against Adam Schiff and the other House managers who had brought this prosecution.
I want to give a listen now to White House counsel Pat Cipollone saying that the White House team is going to wrap up by dinner time and calling on the U.S. Senate to swiftly bring the impeachment trial to an end. Here he is.
It will show that you put the Constitution above partisanship. It will show that we can come together on both sides of the aisle and end the era of impeachment for good. You know it should end. You know it should end. It will allow you all to spend all of your energy and all of your enormous talent and all of your resources on doing what the American people sent you here to do, to work together, to work with the president, to solve their problems. So this should end now as quickly as possible.
So not just arguing for the president there, but arguing to get this done and get it done quickly.
Yeah, and it was interesting that he decided to end it in a rather somber tone as opposed to any sort of rhetorical fireworks or anything like that. And I think part of that strategy is to say, oh, look, you need to take your constitutional responsibility seriously. And from the Republicans' perspective, that says, well, ending this charade of this impeachment, that's really a political process. Of course, Democrats have a much different view of what their constitutional responsibility is.
Talking to Paul Nolet, associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at the latest on the impeachment proceedings. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. Now that those arguments are done, there are going to be questions and answers. Are there questions you think still need to be answered? And what about the ongoing question of witnesses? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Ray is with us in Milwaukee. Ray, hello.
Hi. I'm not a big supporter of Donald Trump, but I have to say his team, the one point that was a high point for me in listening to all of this, was their exposing the truth, well, part of the truth, of Hunter Biden and the misstatements from him and his lawyers of why he had the position at the Ukrainian company. And I think it would serve the Democrats if they agreed to investigate Hunter Biden for the same reasons that they wanted to investigate Donald Trump. Thank you.
Ray, thanks for the call. And that's something that Republicans have been saying, that there's an equivalence between Hunter Biden's behavior and what the president is accused of. What do you make of that effort by the White House team?
Yeah, and I think it is an effort to shift some of the spotlight away from Trump's behavior and to look at Biden's behavior, I mean, specifically Hunter Biden. But that also encapsulates some of what Joe Biden may have done as well. So some of it's trying to shift the spotlight, I think. But I think from Democrats' perspective, they say, look, even if there are some questions about that, that is not relevant to this inquiry in this impeachment trial, which is about President Trump's actions and his efforts to press the Ukrainians to act against his political rival. So I think from their perspective, they say, look, if you're interested in learning more about Hunter Biden, we can take that up outside the context of this impeachment trial, but this should be focused on Trump's behavior.
And we heard from Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst. She's in Iowa. Some voting coming up there, the first voting in the 2020 presidential primary. Here's her talking earlier today about how this could affect the caucuses.
Iowa caucuses, folks. Iowa caucuses are this next Monday evening. And I'm really interested to see how this discussion today informs and influences the Iowa caucus voters, those Democratic caucus goers. Will they be supporting Vice President Biden at this point?
So the original goal that President Trump is accused of is trying to get people to talk about Joe Biden and Ukraine. And now with the impeachment hearings, a Republican senator hoping that people are talking about Joe Biden and the Ukraine and the Ukraine issue as they go to vote. The political fallout. Can you talk about that, Paul?
Yeah. And I mean, I think some of these questions as the campaign goes on are going to be there surrounding Biden. And so he's going to have some answers for that. I think in the immediate term, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, whether this does a couple things. One, it rallies Democrats around Biden, and two, as a way to defend him against Trump, who obviously is not popular amongst Democrats, and also whether this also helps to highlight perhaps that Biden might be the strongest candidate against Trump. You know, it may be that Trump is going after Biden so hard here because he sees him as the toughest candidate for Trump to beat. And if Democrats get that impression, then they're more likely to vote for Biden, I think, both in the Iowa caucuses and moving on. So I'm not sure if that's going to happen, but certainly Bernie Sanders has had some momentum in the recent days. But it is, I think, a dynamic that potentially could help Joe Biden in the Democratic caucuses.
Talking to Paul Nolet about today's Senate impeachment trial. He's an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Both sides have made their basic cases. What do you think about the proceedings so far? How do you want the trial to be handled now by Republicans and Democrats in the Senate? Should they bring in witnesses like John Bolton? We'll talk about him in just a few moments. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about the Senate impeachment trial. Paul Nolet is with us from Marquette University. You can join in with your thoughts, questions, reactions, and what you're watching for next at 800-642-1234. Paul, before we go to our callers, briefly, the John Bolton issue. We've been talking about this a lot this week, this manuscript, his book draft comes out. It says, hey, I'm a firsthand witness to a lot of this, and there was, the president said to me, in effect, yeah, we're going to withhold this military aid from Ukraine unless they investigate the Bidens. And the question is, are they going to bring him to testify? What are you watching for there?
Yeah, and it really comes down to at least four key senators, Republican senators, who would need to flip and join all the Democrats, assuming all the Democrats go along with calling witnesses, in order to have John Bolton and perhaps others testify. So in some ways, I think today, even more significant than the words of Trump's legal team, were actually some of the developments behind the scenes that may be pushing at least four Republican senators closer to agreeing to call witnesses, including John Bolton. So I think, senators like Mitt Romney, who have already publicly said that he's open to witnesses, Senator Susan Collins from Maine is another one to really look at, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. There's a few senators who are going to be really important to look at to see if they agree to call witnesses.
Let's go back to our callers now. Kelly is with us in Cascade. Kelly, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm just strongly putting my vote out for witnesses to be called on behalf of the American people. It just feels like there's not going to feel like any resolution in this whole thing if we don't hear from witnesses, and we, the people, need to feel resolved about this one way or the other, and I feel like witnesses are the only way that's going to make that happen.
Kelly, thanks for the call. Paul, if the president is acquitted without having called witnesses, maybe as soon as this Friday, are there going to be people out there, maybe even not just Democrats, feeling like they didn't do, I don't know, their due diligence?
I think so. And actually, there's been a number of Republicans who I think are worried about that. And apparently, I mean, it was reported that today Mitt Romney had talked to a number of his fellow Republican senators, and he brought up that very point, saying that actually, even politically, this would be a good move to call witnesses, because otherwise it won't really seem like an exoneration like President Trump has aimed for. So I think things seem to me to be moving in the direction that witnesses will actually be called, but it's still not clear that that's actually going to happen. I think there's still some persuasion that needs to happen.
Thanks, Kelly, for the call. Kay joins us now in Racine. Kay, hi.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I used to be a registered Republican, and I am very convinced that the Democrats presented an excellent case, and I believe that there was definitely quid pro quo, and I think that there is a very dangerous precedent that has been set, because with the president denying any records or documents being allowed to be inspected, essentially he is eliminating the opportunity for impeachment in the future of any president, because all they have to do is say, no, I didn't do it, and no, I won't give you anything.
Okay, thanks for the call. Paul, what do you think of that last point the president set by the president not allowing people to talk to Congress at all, not releasing a lot of these documents?
Yeah, and I think that is a very important point to remember about the impeachment process, is that at least when it is targeted towards the president, it happens so infrequently that whatever does happen really does set a precedent for potential future impeachments. And so actually a lot of the discussion today and throughout the last few days of opening statements was about that precedent, with Republicans arguing that this is setting the precedent for a political impeachment, whereas Democrats and the caller Kay also brought this up, mentioning that this could set a precedent where a president can essentially do whatever they want without any fear of retribution if the Congress doesn't take their duty seriously. So I do think that the question of precedent is certainly a very important one here.
Okay, thanks for that call. We're talking to Paul Nolet from Marquette University, looking at the latest in the Senate impeachment trial. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. I think conditioning giving money to another country is frequently, if not always, accompanied by an encouragement that they minimize corruption. And I think part of the fear of this is that it may expose something which is very common in our government, where bribes are funneled via family members for people in power to force policies here or abroad that profit whoever's paying the bribes, as in the case of the Bidens with Burisma.
Jim, thanks for the call. Paul, and this has been a Republican argument too. Hey, it's the president was just trying to combat corruption in Ukraine when he was holding off the delivery of this military aid money.
Yeah, I mean, and that's definitely one of the key arguments that Trump and his legal team are making. Again, trying to shift that spotlight to the Bidens. And you know, it can be just politically, I think it can be a powerful argument, because both on the left and the right sides of the political spectrum, the concern about people in power being able to do things that regular Americans aren't able to do is something that is a continuous theme in the rhetoric of Donald Trump as well as Bernie Sanders. And so you hear this quite a bit. And I think Trump's lawyers and Trump himself realize that and realize the power of that argument, at least rhetorically, during this entire impeachment process.
And then the counter argument has been that the president focused on two specific things, involving the name Biden, and then an allegation that Ukraine had interfered, had opposed him in the 2016 election, and not really any wider issues or concerns about corruption seeming to come up in testimony. Is that what do you make of that argument?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, I think a lot of the evidence here, going back to that transcript from President Trump himself released of his conversation with Zelensky, certainly does raise the question of, well, what real commitment did the president have to rooting out corruption versus trying to go after one of his political opponents, in this case, of course, Biden. And so I think the House managers did, in my view at least, did a quite solid job of putting forward the Democrats' argument here, which is that this wasn't really about corruption. It was about Trump pressuring Ukraine to go after a political rival. Whether you think that Trump's legal team effectively rebutted that argument, I think is going to depend a lot on whether you think that this entire process is just hopelessly political or not.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Jim. A lot more callers on the line. I'm afraid we won't have time to get to them all. But, Paul, I want to have you in our last minute preview what happens next. We've had these opening arguments. Now what?
Yeah, so a couple of key steps. So over the next 2 days, senators will have the opportunity to ask questions. And this is going to be different than how the Senate typically works, because they have to submit questions to the Chief Justice, John Roberts, who will then read the questions, and then Trump's legal team will have an opportunity to respond. So that will happen in 8-hour chunks over the next 2 days. Then I think the real fireworks are going to start on Friday, when it's likely that the debate over calling additional witnesses and other potential motions will happen. And that's where we're going to know whether the impeachment trial will end very soon, perhaps even as early as the weekend, or go potentially for another couple of weeks.
A lot to watch this week. Paul, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
Paul Nolet is an associate professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Marquette University. He joins today to talk about the latest news in the impeachment trial of President Trump in the U.S. Senate. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, if you're really busy at work, there's a good chance you're doing a bad job. Our guest tells us why constantly being busy can actually hurt our job performance, and we'll find out why some businesses are trying to lighten the load. If you give workers less work, the jobs will get done better. We'll get some of the latest news on the Senate impeachment trial, including, as we just heard, the opening part of the question and answer step of the process. And then sometimes quitting is the best way to win. We'll hear stories of people who quit things, from bad habits to jobs to relationships and how it changed their lives. And you can share maybe your story of quitting something and how it affected your life. That and a look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7:30, a San Francisco 49ers assistant coach will be the first woman to coach at the Super Bowl this weekend. Kate and her guests look at women in the sport of football, including a women's league with a team here in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk with John McGivern from the public TV show Around the Corner with John McGivern and the co-creator of the show about the best places in Wisconsin to live, work, and play. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Did you know that you can donate your car to Wisconsin Public Radio and get a tax deduction? Oh, we take trucks too, and boats, RVs, even snowmobiles. We'll tow it away for free at a time that's convenient for you, and Wisconsin Public Radio will get a donation in your name. Turn your old vehicle into the programs you love. Go to WPR.org/support, and thank you.
Have you heard that podcast with those two wacky guys, Paul and Rick?
Oh, yeah. Hey, Elisa, play Paul and Rick's podcast.
Playing Politics Podcast.
This is the WPR Politics Podcast.
Whoa. Wait a minute. That's not Paul and Rick. Where's Paul and Rick?
Playing Politics Podcast.
We dig deep into the headlines affecting Wisconsinites.
Huh. I guess this sounds kind of cool.
Subscribe now at WPR.org/politics.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The president's legal team wrapped up its opening argument to senators today against President Donald Trump's removal from office.